My name is Bill Maddox. I'm the new chair of the Village Square, taking the reins from Rabbi Romberg, whom you all know. And I want to welcome you to another edition of Faith Food Friday. We're glad that you're here. We've got a very challenging topic that we're going to get to hear many of our regulars speak to. We also have a special guest today that I want to introduce down on the far end. This is Ryan Sprague. Ryan is someone who's been around Tallahassee for a long time, played football here at Florida State University for Bobby Bowden, and then now is involved in the work of the Phi Center, which I'm sure he'll have a chance to talk to you about. I know Ryan through a group that's very Village Square-ish, meets Wednesday mornings. It's called Skeptics, and we get together, read books, discuss, and Ryan has really impressed me in that group. He's someone who gets what we do here, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from him today. Just a couple of items before we start. Next Tuesday, if you don't have tickets yet to our dinner series, you better get them quick because we only have a few seats left for a program that we're going to be doing about truth and trolls and all about media and fake news. I think you'll really enjoy it. Next Thursday, we also have a special program that's part of our Local Color series that's devoted to commemorating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Jackie Robinson in nearby Cairo. And we've got a cousin of Jackie and the Jackie Robinson of FSU coming along with a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. So I think you'll really enjoy that program. It's going to be at the Challenger Center. There should be information on your tables about it. And I think that's the... Liz will tell me later if I missed something. But without further ado, let me turn it over to our host for this event, Rabbi Jack Romberg.
Thanks, Bill. Let me just put this here. Okay, so a couple of things. Number one, welcome to Temple Israel. We're pleased to, of course, always be hosting Faith Food Friday for the Village Square. Thank you. I can't do anything without Stephanie. I mean, she's like... number one is March the 3rd. Sunday, March the 3rd is the Jewish Food and Cultural Festival.
And before that... on February 9th is the World Culture Festival at Good Samaritan.
So, of course, many people have come already, and you can go online on the Temple Israel website or our Facebook page to pre-order your sandwiches. And believe me, you want to pre-order the sandwiches. And all of this is coming from Carnegie Deli's organization again. So we're very much looking forward to it. Number two, on your tables, you will see a pamphlet called Ode to Understanding. This is a special concert featuring the Morehouse Choir. And it features a piece of music written by Joel Thompson called The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed, written for a male chorus and orchestra. It's the work Seven Movements quotes utterances from unarmed black men before they were shot and killed by authority figures. And then the other piece of music performed with the large choir is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. This is going to be on March 31st, and it is very, very worthwhile to go see this concert. With that, I want to turn it over to Betsy Ouellette, who is our moderator for today.
Derek and I are going to trade off a little because he has some great questions that you might hear him ask the rest of us. It's a little awkward being the only female on the panel for this particular subject, but I want to take the opportunity to tell you a little bit about where I'm at. I was the director of the Phi Center years ago. Ryan Sprague is currently the director of the Phi Center. It's a pregnancy center that was founded by mostly Catholic lay people in churches. Years ago, right after Roe v. Wade, and we, back in the day, provided pregnancy tests before they were readily available, and support for adoption and support for women that wanted to keep their babies that had difficulty doing that. Ryan will give you an update, I'm sure, about the kinds of things they're doing now, which includes some training. So I used to be the director of a pro-life pregnancy center. I think that back in the day when Planned Parenthood was coming to the colleges, when I was in college in the 80s, There was not the technology that we have now with ultrasound. And there was, I think, a little mystery about what happened in the early months. That is no longer the case. Everybody knows what's going on inside the womb early on. The ultrasound technology is incredible. I know that when my daughter lost her pregnancy at 7 weeks, we mourned and we grieved. So that's kind of just almost moot anymore. We know what's going on there. That doesn't necessarily mean that we all believe the same things about what needs to happen regarding difficult decisions around abortion. I think the thing that is most troubling to me is the dualistic nature of the conversation. Pro-choice, pro-life, those are very dualistic designations, and they imply things that are not necessarily true for the moderate middle. Lots of us have varying viewpoints. We're all pro-life, right? And most of us are pro-choice at some level, too. And I'm not talking about just the issue of abortion. So my hope is, because the vast majority of Americans do not see the issue as black and white, and that this dualistic language has not helped, my hope is that we would have a conversation allowing differing voices this morning away from those ends, and we'll see what happens. So my first question for the panel is, didn't he get introduced?
Bill introduced.
That's Ryan. That's Ryan.
Jack Romberg.
And by the way, the woman I hired to follow me is the woman who hired Ryan. So it's a very interesting kind of connection. And I'll say more if it's appropriate later. So my first question to the panel is, how does your faith inform your view on Roe v. Wade? In other words, how does your faith inform your view on legal abortion? Jack, you want to start?
Okay. There is not just one answer to this. If we go back to Exodus chapter 21, verses 22, 23, you have an incident where it describes that if two men are fighting and they bump into a woman who's pregnant, then the woman loses her child, that the person who caused that will be fined. They will pay a fine. And then it goes on to say that if there's further damage, in other words, perhaps if the woman herself dies, doesn't say that specifically, but that's one of the implications, that there's more damage, then it's life for a life, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, et cetera, et cetera. What Jewish tradition does with that in the Talmud is prioritize what is called fully formed human life over life in the womb. Now, it's very clear in the Talmud that a fetus is considered to be life. It is considered to be life. But that fully formed human life has the priority, so that the decisions made throughout Jewish history are decisions that favor the life of the woman carrying the baby. And there's even a very specific piece in the Talmud that says, if the woman's life is in danger of falling, even while the baby is being born, the baby can be aborted or killed or whatever in order to save the life of the mother. And there have been all kinds of incidents throughout Jewish history, even in the last couple of centuries, in which it has become clear, and I'm not talking about a liberal Jewish perspective or anything, because I'm giving examples actually from Orthodox Judaism. There was an Orthodox Jew rabbi in the early 20th century in Israel who made a judgment. He was told by a doctor that if a woman carried her baby, was pregnant with a baby, that she would actually become blind from the pregnancy. Now, I don't know how a doctor could figure that out. All I'm getting at is that the rabbi made a decision to allow the abortion to happen because he was afraid that it would cause the blindness of the woman. So to summarize, a fetus is considered to be life, but Judaism does specifically prioritize what we call fully formed human life over fetal life.
Right.
As a Christian, a belief that every human life is sacred and has a certain dignity, and that a life begins at conception, that there's something new that's created when a male sperm is joined with an egg, and there's fertilization, there's conception, and that you have something new. You have a human being, you have in a beginning development perhaps, but this is something that left to its natural process will become, is something new, and it's a human being. And because that's life, and because it's something special, it needs to be treated the right way. In the Catholic faith, we have something that I think would be kind of similar to what Jack is describing, what we call the principle of double effect. It's a principle in moral theology developed by Thomas Aquinas. The idea being if the woman's life is in danger, again, there could be some leeway there about how we handle an unborn human being, which would be you're not intentionally trying to kill a child, you're trying to save the life of a mother, and that's something different. I don't think that in our current climate that that's the majority of abortions. I know people who have worked with Open Door Women's Clinic and so on, and I rarely ever hear about a woman coming in there looking for information on abortion because her life is in danger or her health is in danger.
I'm in the same category with Tim. From a Christian perspective, all life is precious, and that is including at conception. And I believe that, and I believe that life should have the right to be able to come to full fruition and grow and become what God ordained for it to be.
Yeah, and I would add two components to it. One of them being that I believe that we are called, because of my Christian faith, I believe we are called to act compassionately towards other people, both in the Old Testament and the New, this call to care for widows, care for orphans. There's something in the way that God made us that has called us to look out for the marginalized, look out for the victimized, to care for those who are defenseless. And that mandate from God in our created design, I believe, compels us to care for the life in the womb from conception all the way till natural death at the end. And on top of that, secondarily, I would add, in the New Testament, you see a very clear expectation for this relationship between a parent and a child, or two spouses to one another, to make sacrifices to care for the other person. So I believe that there's also that innate, inherent quality that is a very maternal and beautiful thing that moms will sacrifice for the benefit of their children. I believe it's ordered. I believe it's how we're designed to do things. So I believe that in the process of an abortion, we're kind of violating part of what God made in us, in this person who is called to sacrifice and care for other people. And so on top of the things that they said, I believe that overarching principle that we're called to love other people, care for other people, especially those who can't care for themselves, motivates my faith and motivates me in this conversation.
Okay, so what you all said was your perspective on life, not necessarily your perspective on legal abortion. So I also am a Christian and was the director of the FI Center, and I am for legal abortion, limited, but I will tell you why. Statistically, countries that have legal abortion have fewer abortions. The other question that I think needs to be addressed is the reality that the abortions are decreasing 24% just in the last, since 2015, 26% a drop in rates of abortion. The lowest abortion rates are in Western Europe, where modern methods of contraception and after Plan B, morning after contraception is available, and where abortion is legal. The highest rate of abortions are in Latin America, where women have a hard time even getting contraception. So I think we need to have a conversation about contraception, at least maybe with you, Tim, starting with you.
Well, first comment on that. When I talk about the death penalty, one thing I always bring up is a lot of times the people who are against the death penalty, they bring up arguments such as, you know, this is what happens in Iran and North Korea, or that the death penalty is racist, or that it shows no sign of actually deterring crime, or that it's more expensive than keeping them in prison and so on. And my thing is always that none of that matters. It doesn't matter if every country does the death penalty. It doesn't matter if it does deter crime. It doesn't matter if it's cheaper. None of those things matter. The question is whether or not it's right. whether or not it's right or is it wrong. And so whether, to me, it doesn't matter whether we could show that less abortions happen or not. It's what are we saying as a nation? Because I find it difficult to believe that we would have more abortions in this country if it was illegal and on the black market, or you had to go find it somehow. I think that the message that would be sent to this society is that there's something wrong here. And then we would have to, it would cause more reflection and pause if we as a society embraced life and said, look, this is something sacred. It would change behavior sexually with contraception and so on. But I think just because that's the fundamental question to me is whether or not this is right or is it wrong? Is it something that does a child in the womb have a right to life? Should it be protected by law just as much as my rights are? And that's the question.
And I would add, I think there's a value in defining terms there too. The idea that abortions have reduced, and then because we've had things like Plan B and the morning after pill, I would argue the Plan B and the morning after pill both are abortifacients. They're designed to not prevent conception. They're designed to terminate a conception.
That's not true. That's not medically true.
Encourage you, if you struggle with this belief, look up the Plan B, buy yourself some, read the box. The box will tell you specifically what it is designed to do. It is designed to thin a uterine wall. It is designed to expel a conceived child from, well, again,
that is not true.
Okay, again, don't take my word for it. I would encourage you to look it up.
I think you've been misinformed.
I would encourage you to get the box itself.
It prevents release of an egg. It prevents fertilization, and it prevents implantation.
Implantation of what?
It's possible that it could have been a fertilized egg, but it's very rare, and it prevents implantation, so that means it is never an embryo.
Okay. Very rare.
So anyway, we can discuss the differences there.
Look it up. Plan B pill or the morning after pill.
Okay. So.
So, let me chime in here, because this is getting where it's getting. For me, it's simple. I understand we're talking about legal abortion, illegal abortion. The fact of the matter is, what we haven't talked about is a woman who actually had an abortion. Have we ever talked to that lady and asked her side effects? Because there is also women who have been documented who talked about the impact it has had on them psychologically and things of that nature. I think it's interesting whenever government or individuals have these conversations. I'm against abortion, legal or illegal. I'm against abortion. I think again, from conception, that child has a right to live. But I also think from a pastoral standpoint, from a clergy standpoint, that yes, I want to help that family out. I want to be there for that mother in that regard. But what's important for us to remember as well, and again, our faith will formulate our opinion. From a Christian standpoint, I think that all life has purpose. I think it all has purpose. My parents were not married when I was born. So in some contexts, I should have never been born because I was about married. I was born out of wedlock. Having said that, my life has purpose. And the guy that you see today is because my mother made a choice to keep me. My point in that regard is very, very simple. Very, very simple. In this regard, at what point does the child inside the woman, who speaks for the child, who gives the child a chance to come to fruition in that regard? I think that's important. In addition to that is, we're talking about stats of high or low. Let's talk about the stats. Somebody should give me the stats of the lady who had the abortion. What happened to her? What happened to her medically? What happened to her mentally? In that regard, because yes, these procedures happen. I get it from many countries, but what about the afterlife? Because from a pastoral standpoint, I'm one of those pastors who actually sit down with an individual who actually has now had an abortion, and they deal with the guilt and the regret and whatever it may be. And I think that's important as well in this conversation. We could talk about Roe v. Wade. It was in 73. I wasn't even born, and I'm respectful of it all. It was voted 7-2. So I mean, it was a majority vote from a Supreme Court standpoint. But I think from a faith community standpoint, we have to be mindful in that we lost our voice in this conversation. Are we being governed by government in this conversation, or are we leading the conversation? And I would submit to you that the faith community has allowed ourselves to be controlled by the narrative, versus being the ones creating the narrative.
I think that we're trying to have a conversation among different viewpoints and faith right now.
I agree with that.
At this moment.
But having said that, but Betsy and Ryan shouldn't go to war either. You guys, obviously, you guys don't agree.
I don't want to go to war, but I want to make the point that there are very clear understandings of what happens medically and scientifically with some of these things, including, yes, a baby is conceived. It's life that is conceived. We're not sidestepping that. What is the goal? What is the goal of this conversation? My goal was that we would really talk about ways to have fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer abortions. So I understand the idealism of your perspectives. I too have that same ideal. So every baby should be born. Every baby should be loved. But that's not what happens in real life. And again, being the only female sitting here, I'm afraid you don't quite understand that a lot of women, when I was at the Phi Center, came because their boyfriends brought them. I had an experience where the woman on the board of the Phi Center who hired me later brought her teenage daughter to me for counseling because she brought that same daughter to have an abortion. They were so embarrassed that in the Christian community that the daughter got pregnant, that value overrode their value of being pro-life people. It's so complex. My hope is that we can get into the complexity. So, Ryan, I apologize if I cut you off.
Actually, let me... I have been sitting quietly here for most of this, and I want to... first of all, I have to give a strong disagreement to my dear friend Derek. And that is, I do not feel the government is taking anything away from me religiously or any Jewish person religiously by the decision of Roe versus Wade. I think there are so many aspects to this that we have to be thinking about. The aspect number one is I'm not a woman. I can't fully appreciate and understand how a woman is going to feel about pregnancy, about what will happen with an abortion. I feel that too much is determined by people who are not sensitive to how women feel. That's one aspect that we have to put out there. Another aspect that I think we have to put out there is the reality that whatever the law is about abortion is not going to increase or decrease the number of pregnancies. It's just not. Before abortion was legal, and for a long time before that, people were having sex and women were getting pregnant, and there was no possibility of them having an abortion. Let me give something personal. My dad is the product of a shotgun wedding. Okay? In Germany in 1923. Okay? So this is something that has gone on for all of human history. And in human history, at various points, we create different kinds of societies that look at things different ways. Okay? The reality of abortion is, if you make it completely illegal, you will increase the amount of women who die because they feel they have to get an abortion and they can't do it.
And it disproportionately affects the poor.
Yes, it disproportionately affects poor. Okay, that's point number two. Point number three, and then I'll shut up to let other people talk. Point number three. I really resent the difference being the explanation or the way things are labeled as pro-life versus pro-choice. I am pro-life, which means that I also believe in the book of Amos that says that we have to do everything possible to help the poor, the orphan, the widow, and not just help the unborn child, which unfortunately too many people ignore.
So either we are really pro-life to help everyone, or we're picking one thing as a topic that we have to fight for. Now, putting all of that together, I'll share one other personal view. I don't like abortion. I don't like abortion at all. I don't know anybody who really likes abortion. My wife and I have adopted children. We wouldn't have had them if they were aborted. We're not people who love abortion. We're grateful that those mothers gave birth, and we had two wonderful daughters that are fabulous to this very day. I also don't approve of abortion as just a way of doing birth control. I think that's wrong. I just think it's wrong. But given all of this, to make it illegal will create more problems, not less.
So I do think there's a deeper issue at hand here, and I'm glad that Betsy kind of mentioned contraception. I do think something I ponder, I was at the March for Life this past weekend with 100 students from FSU and hundreds of thousands of other people. If you don't believe me, watch the time lapse. It wasn't covered by the media, but it's out there. You can see it. There were quite a few people out there. What was covered by the media, sadly, was a beautiful event and everything, but something I always ponder is why, you know, this is so stark, this difference and this conflict, and it's emotional and so on, as we're seeing right here, and what is it that the other side from me, at least, and what is it that they're attracted to? And I think in some ways it's compassion, right? They see a woman or a couple that gets pregnant. They weren't expecting to get pregnant. Perhaps it was a one-night stand. Perhaps it was rape. Perhaps however it happened. It wasn't intended. It wasn't what they wanted. And now they're dealing with a tremendous consequence of a human life, carrying the pregnancy and then at least 18 years right afterward. And so there's sort of this, well, we want to kind of let them off the hook. Maybe perhaps because we're aware of our own failures, our own mistakes, and well, it could have been me or so on. And so there is an attraction, I think, to mercy, an attraction to compassion on the side that supports legal abortion. That being said, I think as a culture, I don't think abortion is as much of a legal issue. As you know, I don't like to look to the government for solutions, as I think it's a heart issue. And Betsy brought up contraception. And the fact is that human beings come about in existence in only one way that I'm aware of naturally, through sex. And right now, and I have to say that, sadly, because I think our society has forgotten that. Every song, a movie, television show, basically the culture right now, when is sex ever attached to childbearing? Very rarely. And that is because of contraception. And so babies don't just happen. Right, it happens because it was a result of sex. And when we say, you know, in an ideal world, yes, it might be idealism, but what the Catholic Church proclaims is that sexual acts should only occur within marriage. And that maybe that's crazy for us to think that could ever happen. And it's probably never happened. Jack's right. This has been going on. Human beings have been human beings forever. But do you think that there's more promiscuity now than there was 100 years ago? Do you think that there's more? There's definitely more out of wedlock childbirths. There's a lot more of that going on than there was some time ago.
Actually, out-of-wedlock childbirths have been decreasing.
The last numbers that I saw were getting close to 50%. So compared to 100 years ago or something else, it might be decreasing since last year, and that would be a good thing. But I don't think there's any doubt that the value of sexual acts and so on, that there's been a strong cultural shift, especially since the 1960s. My only thing is this. If we can come back to the meaning of what sexuality is, and what it's for. And I just ask you to do an imaginary experiment in your mind. If every act, sexual act, took place within a loving, committed, married couple, would this world be a better place or a worse place?
It would be a better place.
Okay.
And it's just really sad that that's not really the case. Never, hardly ever is that the case 100% of the time, right?
But when
in
we set that
town,
up
any
as
any village, any country.
Then we set that up as an ideal in our society, rather than one-night stands and contraception and so on, when we set that up as an ideal in our society, it calls us to the dignity of what it is to be human. It calls us to be a better, to strive to be something, not just follow my desires and my instincts. If my instincts, C.S. Lewis said, if the human male entertained his sexual instinct, he would have enough children to populate a village. Right? To make us human is to rise above that and to say, no, I'm not going to do that. And it means also to treat women with respect and with dignity, that they're not sexual objects. Let me ask you this. Are women today treated better? Are they more treated like sexual objects than they were 100 years ago?
I would say absolutely.
It's totally different now. Right? And there's a lot of things that women have accomplished. And
I'm not sure that's true.
Well, walk around on FSU's campus. I think it's pretty clear.
I know what you're referring to. I know what you're referring to, the sexualization of females. But
watch MTV, anything on television.
I also think that we've come a long way, and I'm sitting up here as a ordained United Methodist woman. That wasn't even possible until 1978. I think we are making forward strides.
Amen.
I think you just reduced the female population.
Without discounting the progress that's been made as well. Okay, without discounting that, I think things have changed. And I think we need to look again at how we present sexuality, what the meaning of it is. And I think contraception and I think abortion, what it does is it robs us of that. I think what it does is, and the real issue, why people are very, very serious about this in some way, it's not, it says protecting women, but it's really, we want to be able to do what we want. And when we have carefree sex and we have it, like it is today, there is a very real possibility that you're going to have a very serious consequence of a human life as a result of it. And I don't think we like to look at that.
I'm going to say to people, put your hands down. People will have a chance to come up and ask questions. Let the conversation continue up here. I will just make another little perspective in terms of sexuality or sexual relationships. In Judaism, yes, we do say it should be a sexual relationship between husband and wife. However, the purpose of sex is not just to have children. The purpose of sex, according to our tradition, is for actually two half souls to become one soul. Teaching in the Talmud about how it used to be years, like 2,000 years ago. The idea was that if a couple didn't have a child within so many years, then the woman had the right to divorce the man. It was then ruled in the Talmud on a case of that the husband and wife did not want to leave each other because they were so deeply in love with each other. And so that puts sexuality in the context that it is a way for husband and wife to tie themselves together in a deep way.
I know Ryan has something he wants to add, but I think we're, all of us as faith, people of faith and faith leaders, we all would agree on that ideal is what our faith teaches. So that's not really in discussion here.
Sure, but I mean, Derek kind of hinted at the idea of who's leading who. Is it society or government leading the faith, or is faith influencing society and government? I think this is the challenge when we abandon the ideal. We can recognize that we're not living or seeing the ideal lived out, but then if because of that we abandon the ideal, we no longer have anything to strive for. We no longer are giving an example for the next generation to see. And I think that's kind of what we're hinting at here, is that if we allow, or we not tolerate, but if we accept that the ideal is just gone, we won't have that anymore. Again, what are we pushing toward? What are we going to get? And I think what happens is when we unmoor ourselves as a society, or we unmoor ourselves as a civilization from this idea of a strong foundation, from a base, what happens is the weak are the ones who are harmed. And what happens in this scenario is we end up with people who are in positions of power, positions of authority, who can oppress or who can crush down on those who are in more victim states. And we see this, what's happening, in my opinion, to women. When the whole idea of contraception way back a long, long time ago in the 1900s, when Margaret Sanger and that crew were really trying to push this forward, was there was a desire to see women given the same kind of access to the career force, given the same kind of access and treatment as men. And the belief was their reproductive system was keeping that from happening, that the man could go to work and she had to stay home for 9 months and take care of the baby, or then maybe stay home for years and take care of the baby. And they felt that was unequal. So we wanted to make sure that they have equal access to the workforce. And over the years, the contraception conversation has changed. It became one of sexual liberty. And to the point that was made earlier, what we have seen is women are more and more and more objectified. Women are more and more and more harmed. Women are more and more and more the ones that are left to carry the burdens, carry the responsibilities, carry the wounds from irresponsible men who have had what's held up in front of them, no standard. The whole Me Too movement was born out of the idea that you have a lot of men, positions of power and otherwise, abusing women in the form of sexual abuse. And that sexual abuse leads to trauma and to heartache. And my position is, both with abortion and with sex in general, we've got to maintain the ideal that sex is designed to be between a man and a woman, and in a marriage of commitment and faithfulness and security and mutual support and sacrifice, that's where it belongs. And if a baby is on the way, our job is to protect, to care for, and sacrifice for the baby. Again, while as a husband and as a father of six and a father who's also lost two babies through miscarriage, I know the reality of parenthood and I know the reality of loss, but I also know I don't know it to the same degree my wife does. There's not a man in this room who can understand the aftermath of an abortion the way that a woman can. And there's not a man in this room that can understand the actual procedure of an abortion the way that a woman can. It is my position that if we are saying it is a sign of women's liberty or it is a sign of advancement of society, that a woman will then have to undergo not only the contraception, that she's got to chemically affect her body and poison her body because men are being irresponsible, but then if a child does come, she's got to go through a DNC or she's got to go through some sort of other chemical-induced abortion, I think that's hurtful, that's traumatizing. And we as a society can do better, and we as men can do better, and what we need to do is continue to push men to do better.
I think that
not every woman would agree with your analysis. And, but here is my main point. My main point is But here is my main point. If you take your perspective and use it to illegalize abortion, in other words, not have it legal at all, what you are doing is forcing a very particular religious perspective on everybody. And that is not appropriate.
Yeah, but let me chime in. I know we got to go to the audience. So here's the frustration of this conversation. Similar to the conversation about homosexuality is if you don't align with the thinking, then you're homophobic. What Ryan is saying is Ryan's position. Like it or don't like it, it's his position. And out of respect, it's his position. You may not agree with it. I can find statistics that can go for and against situations. May not agree with it. And that's fine. But this conversation is not going to be won in an hour. It's just not going to happen. Having said that, the fact of the matter is we can have one group who will defend abortion and defend the woman's right to have it. Another group who will say, what about the baby? That is the reality where we are right now. We can talk about being pro-life. I get it. But ladies and gentlemen, the five of us up here, we're not going to agree in the day on what we look at abortion. We're just not going to do it. Even as Christians, we're going to look at it totally different. But his viewing is his viewing. Like it or don't like it, is his viewing.
Okay, thank you.
No, I hear that, Betsy, but
no.
I understand you're moderating.
No,
but
I don't like to share my opinion.
But out of respect, I get that, but out of respect, I'm not trying to be a woman, but I was asked to be on a panel about abortion. Don't give it my opinion about how I see abortion.
Okay.
And you may not like it. That's okay.
Welcome to share. That's why we're here.
I gotta say that I respect. Just being realistic again. I respect my colleagues' positions and that abortion is horrible and so on. But this is gonna prevent. But I don't hear that in the culture. Okay, when New York passed this law the other day, no one said like it's so horrible that we have to pass this law. It's so awful that we have to extend the ability for women to have abortions even up to the day of their birth. This is the worst thing ever, but if we don't pass this law, there'll be even more of it, right? And the people who support pro-choice, none of them are out there saying, I've seen women just say, I'm proud of my abortion, the signs and the protests. The culture is not out there saying, abortion is like the worst thing ever, it is the last resort, but gosh, we gotta have it just to, because that way women's lives will be saved and so on, and if we don't, it'll be more illegal. You know, I don't hear that. Have sex, no consequences. I mean, that's the reality. That's what our culture says.
Okay, so again, this is a dualistic conversation, more or less. I think maybe Jack and I are saying things that are a little bit more complex. I believe that we can hold up the ideal of one man, one woman for life, children born in wedlock. That is an ideal that I as a Christian hold. And have not been able to live up to in that I have been divorced. I carry the pain of that and the failure of that, and I also carry the joy of the grace of God. Ideals are important. We want to teach our faith. Couldn't we not hold up this ideal that is so beautiful and I think most of us would embrace and still have a conversation about the reality? Meg, you said about birth control and Margaret Sanger, it was to put women in the workforce. But remember, it was the women who were trying to feed their children that kept coming and kept coming. It was because women had no control over how many kids came along, and they couldn't feed them. When I was in India, in a small village, there was a woman, very poor. She had twins. She came to our clinic. It was clear to me that one of the babies was thriving and one was not. I found out later she wasn't feeding one of the babies because that she couldn't afford that baby. That is heartbreaking to me. If that woman had access to Plan B, which in my opinion and from what I understand would have prevented a pregnancy, that would have been a humane thing to do for her.
Do you think the baby would prefer to be alive or not to exist?
I think the baby wouldn't know because it wasn't a baby. It never would have become a baby. It would have prevented the implantation.
It's just
the
question. How many of you would prefer not to exist?
I don't think that's a fair question.
So, I think it's a great question.
So let me ask.
Beethoven was born into a horrible situation, and we just advertised this concert, right? Beethoven's Ninth. Praise God for me that he was allowed to live and that they didn't have abortion allowed because his circumstances he was born into, he would have been aborted.
I'm talking about preventing a pregnancy.
Let me put out something that
Betsy, you said it's not a baby. You made it.
Right, it's not.
Okay, so then you're not talking about preventing a pregnancy. You're talking about ending a current pregnancy.
No, preventing a pregnancy.
So a
plan B would be something, and some of you might not know that, but this is over the counter now and legal. And if you have unprotected sex or something happens and you do not want to become pregnant, this pill prevents pregnancy.
So let me throw something out that I think maybe the people, you know, with me up here would agree with, that as religious leaders, I don't know that there's any one of us up here that doesn't feel that whether it's a fetus or whether it's a baby or whether it's a grown person, each one of them is life, okay? Yeah. Nobody disagrees with that, correct? Okay. And I think that nobody would disagree with that as religious leaders, we should be trying to urge and teach in our congregations respect for life, period, okay? And I think that all of us would agree that that we should be teaching in our congregations urging people to be dedicated to each other in a marriage relationship, that sexuality should be focused in there and not just, you know, playing around. Okay, would any of us disagree with that? No, I think we all would agree with that. Where we are disagreeing, and this is, I think, what we have to think about is, to what level do we expect the government to pass a law to dictate to each of us? And that is the problem that we're having, is that we are, and I understand this. I understand this, why people will want the government to do this. But that's the real question. Because often we object to the government interfering or passing laws that regulate other things, but then we will want the government to pass a law to forbid or to regulate this. And there is our difficulty. There is our disagreement. There is our problem up here. So I'm wondering if there's a way for us to come together to agree that within our congregations, within our, you know, the places that we are, we should be pushing a certain level of commitment to life, but we have to think about to what degree are we trying to push our perspective across a board of people that don't necessarily share the same religious perspective.
I think that's an interesting choice of language, because earlier you said, when I shared my first position, that that's one limited religious perspective dictating to the masses, and you were taking issue with that. And I would say that if this is our position, that we're concerned about a religious perspective ruling over a pluralistic society, I think that's valid. So I would say let's abandon it. Let's abandon all of the religious back and forth. Let's abandon the Talmud and let's abandon the Bible. And let's go just with science. As Betsy opened up the conversation, everyone now knows that from the moment that a sperm and an egg are joined, you have something new and distinct, that it is no longer merely a woman's body. And if we go with purely science, biology, embryology, and that's all we're looking at as our defining characteristic, now we now have a person, which is why in Roe v. Wade, when they made their ruling, they said if this personhood question comes to be defined, the entire ruling is moot. The entire ruling should be thrown out because this personhood question confused them. We now know a whole lot more than we knew in 1973 when they were wrestling with that conversation. Now, my religious belief affirms what we're now finally observing in science, and I would say we've been saying it for millennia, but now science is there too. So let's throw out the Talmud, throw out scriptures, and go only by science, and let science say this is objectively real, it is distinct, it is human, it is not only the mother, it is its own thing, and let's give it the same legal protection that every single citizen has in this country, and let the Constitution rule.
Well, I also think that there's another thing happening with freezing of embryos.
Terrific.
And I know a lot, I know pro-life Christian couples that are freezing their embryos. And I have some struggle with that ethically because it seems like two sides of talking out of two sides of your mouth.
Well, you're saying you're struggling that they shouldn't participate in that?
I'm wondering how someone can participate in that and still be so pro-life regarding embryos that are carried in the womb.
I mean, for consistency, I believe that's also
right,
I mean,
okay.
I believe the whole idea of surrogacy and in vitro fertilization and all that stuff, I believe, contradicts the way that we're supposed to do it, which I think Tim in the Catholic position would have a very similar position on this. I agree. I think that what we've done is we've opened up this Pandora's box, and we've created this problem where we're trying to put remedies on this thing, or putting our fingers in dams in different places, and we're not recognizing that one of the reasons we have all these holes in the dam is because we've abandoned the ideal, which is why I think we need to continue to push back toward that to help address some of those things.
And one reason why I actually can't go along with the scientific approach that you're taking is because here's another scientific approach. Tell me if a one-month-old fetus is exactly the same as a 10-year-old child. No, they are not. There's a difference. And sometimes you have to make difficult choices about life. And that's why it needs to be people in consulting with doctors, clergy, family, to figure out what their choice is and why having a particular religious perspective, have the government dictate that it has to be the same for everyone, can't work.
I think we're ready, Liz.
So I wanted to express my appreciation for the fact that you all can have this very difficult conversation in such a real and respectful way. This is, if we would be in much better shape if we had way more of these conversations. It's very rare. National Public Radio agrees with me that it's very rare, and they asked us to share our tape of today's conversation. And so that's why we're doing questions a little bit differently, because we want to make sure we've got good sound and we get you on audio. So if you have a question, if you can come join me and we'll kind of line up, and you will have to, I don't think I can get all the way over to you, although I may be able to. Nope, you'll have to come to me. So the other thing I wanted to remind you about is, as we have this conversation, if you can refrain from team clapping, the sort of back and forth clapping that we tend to do in circumstances like this.
All right. I wanted to ask the question. It was early in the conversation. I want to acknowledge the ideals that each of the clergy have and the value of life that it has. But what I want to know, in terms of the reality of a woman finding herself pregnant. All right, there's the woman, there's whatever was made up inside of her. And what about the man? Nobody's been talking about the men. And I think we need to have had more conversation, more discussion about the man.
I agree.
I'd like to say, I mean, this ideal that I'm presenting, which is what my church teaches, let me just say, is a very difficult one. Okay, and I'm not innocent in my life's experience. Okay, so don't investigate me. Okay, but let me just say, that's the ideal that we're shooting for. I think that, like I said, this is not a government problem or a political problem as much as it's a spiritual problem. And I think if anyone's to blame the most, to me at least, it's a man. and it's not the woman. And I say that, and this may be controversial to say, and I'm sorry if it offends somebody's sensibilities, but the women that I work with and deal with, what I find is that what they ultimately long for is a man that will give them their life and love them and protect them and be there for them and be a partner for them and respect them. And that's not often what men are doing. And I think sometimes women are sold a false bill of goods and give in and settle for men that are less than what they should be. And yes, often pregnancy happens as a result, and the man is nowhere to be found, and I think that's tragic.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's such an important part of this conversation. And again, this is one of the bitter ironies of this conversation. Most of the young women who come into our center, and they say it's something up 70%-ish around the country, will talk about one of the great pressures they feel, which is making them consider having an abortion, is the lack of support from the biological father of the child or from their own father. They don't feel that sense of support and security. And what's happened is, because we've made this so strongly a woman's choice issue, time and time again I'll have young fathers in our office that say they cannot do anything. They do not believe they can do anything. They cannot speak up because it is her choice. And legally, she's the one that gets to make that decision. And I believe because we've neutered that. We're allowing them to procreate. And we're saying that's all right. But then when it comes to whether or not they're going to father this child, we then have muted them. And a lot of the women, I think, that end up feeling isolated, in part, it's because the rhetoric has become so strong that men are told, stay out of the conversation. So I agree with you. I think it needs to be a part of it. Men need to be accountable, and we need to be holding them to a better standard.
I think more important is what we have to do as religious leaders is to be teaching men how to properly treat women, sure. Period. That's actually the bottom line.
Thank you all. Let me start by saying I work in the public health arena, so that guides a lot of my thoughts. I think we're all missing the mark as a society, as religious institutions, as individuals when it comes to this issue. The ideals that you say about protecting all life, the sanctity of marriage and sex, all that are wonderful ideals. Reality is we will never prevent abortions. We will never prevent extramarital sex. I think we're missing the mark, and Betsy came real close. The issue should not be about preventing or allowing abortion. It should be empowering all men and all women using technology, law, the pulpit, everything, to be able and to be empowered to prevent unwanted pregnancy to begin with. We have the technology, we have some laws, there's a lot we can do, but if everybody who had an opinion about abortion on either side can channel that into preventing unwanted pregnancy to begin with, the problem would go away.
I so am grateful for that, because in the end, my heart is that there will be fewer and fewer unwanted pregnancies and fewer abortions.
If you're willing to, I'd love to get your email address later, just because I've got studies from Sweden, from Spain, from Australia, from the United States, from Planned Parenthood themselves, arguing, saying that the more contraception is increased in a given place, the more abortion has increased in a given place. And what's interesting, again, about your comment is the most profound technology that we have and we ever will have is the design of the human body. And the assumption in the technology question is going to be about proper usage of technology. One of the reasons people joke about the Catholics and about natural family planning is that they don't use it often enough, the proper technique, therefore they end up getting pregnant. The same is true of pills, the same is true as condoms, most of the abortions that occur, people were on contraception when it happened. So it's a false conclusion to believe that just because we have the technology available, the usage would be applied. The same struggle we have as clergy is we're trying to say from a moral perspective, you need to behave effectively. They don't do it the right way. And this is the challenge. So I think it's a false idea to think just because we make technology out there, it'll be better. We're going to be much closer to forced sterilization, which is the worst thing I can imagine us doing. But that's where we might go with trying to utilize technology to solve the problem. But if you're curious about those studies, please get your email before you leave. I can send them to you. These are some of them, like I said, by Planned Parenthood themselves, to share with you this idea that contraception tends to lead to...
You know, it's actually interesting that to me I've been struck more today than I often am with the difference in statistics that we operate on, which is part of our challenge, right? Is we each have sort of part of a big elephant, and we're talking about that part, but not sort of trying to embrace the whole.
First, I just want to say we're so blessed in America that we don't have babies that are born that can't be fed. I mean, poor people have WIC for several years, they have food stamps, they have housing, you know, they get more money when they have a baby, so we don't have that, thank goodness, praise God. But we didn't really talk a whole lot about this new law in New York that was just passed that clear up to the date of the birth. I mean, the woman could be in labor, and we choose to end this life. This is now legal in New York. So, and I know some of you are just pro-life from conception. I think most of Americans aren't there anymore, but I think that a lot of Americans would disagree with pro-choice at the time of birth. So my question is, if you're not at either extreme, when is it okay? When is it not okay? When do we say this really is a life that needs to be protected? The day of the birth, is this a life that needs to be protected? Is it at 20 weeks when it could be viable and has survived a life? For those panelists, when is it okay? When is it not?
I think it just has to be a discussion within the family, I think with clergy, I think with the doctor. I think that it's not a simple, I don't think it's a simple question that can be answered by a law. I think that it has to be a discussion between those that are involved, and that our job as clergy is to give, you know, a moral perspective and to work with our congregants if they're in that situation to try and help them through, to try and help them, you know, think in multiple ways without judging them at all, just to help them think it through. And I would bet that if we do it, we would still be reducing the amounts of abortion.
On the New York law, I you can't convince me that having abortion at late term is not murder. You just can't convince me that's not. And you can argue, we can argue back and forth on, you know, the first 18 days, whether it's a heartbeat or not. If that woman's in her third trimester and she chooses to do an abortion, that's murder. I don't care what New York law says. You just killed a baby that mother has felt doing every movement and every motion. And that law now is telling whomever, the mother, the father, whatever, that the baby has no life whatsoever. And I think those who are pro-abortion, that's your prerogative, but that's murder. That's a life. That is a real life that has been formulating through everything. And you can't tell me that act there in the third trimester isn't different than whatever you do in the first 18 days, if you want to argue from that standpoint. That law literally is allowing you to kill that child. And I would ask the question again then, who speaks for the child in that scenario? Because that is murder.
And I think your question is a one many people struggle with, and this idea of the difference between this life that Betsy was recognizing earlier, this biological reality, and this philosophical religious idea of being a person. And Jack, you've said a number of times you don't think there should be a law kind of restricting us in that way, but I do believe you would probably support laws that prohibit murder, right? Right? So you do have a distinction that you're making, that you believe the government should prohibit murder because we believe in a civil society that should be okay, and yet you draw a line. And what she's asking for is, where is your line? Is that if my position is, again, we're going to go with that biological reality, this conception idea. Right. And so I'm curious, in this room, at what point do you believe it? And I think her question's a good one. And this is where my position earlier that becomes whoever is loudest, whoever has the most control, because whoever has the most control is going to be able to pick wherever their line is. And if you're a guy like Peter Singer at Harvard, you might say it's a two-year-old child that a parent should have the right to eliminate. Other of us might recoil at that, but he's applying a thought pattern. Other people are going to say conception. But I'm just curious to hear y'all answer her question more directly. Do you believe there's a line where the law can protect?
I think, again, that it's more complex than a line. If I was the one that made law and I wanted to be sort of open to the reality of the situations of many people's lives, which does require sometimes the legal abortion, I would say the first trimester. I'm not suggesting that it isn't a growing life. I'm suggesting that in this tragic choice, that would be where I would limit legal abortion.
My only hesitation, and I don't know the detail of the New York law, I have to admit that, but my assumption would be that it's giving permission for it only if there's a threat to the woman's life. And if there is a threat to the woman's life, then that, you know, then you have to look at it differently. Other than that, I would agree that that third trimester is not an appropriate time.
Right. If that was, okay.
Let's take that, another
it does
question.
Say well-being, actually. It doesn't just say the life. It's well-being, and that's where the controversy is. But I just want to say, I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, they lit up the buildings and the bridges in New York. Yeah, they celebrated this. I mean, I just find this fascinating. Like, this is just incredible to me.
And I find that heartbreaking as well.
Yeah, like, yay, we did this. Now you can...
Okay.
Right. I did a little research on this myself this morning because I wanted to find out the answer to this. And that's, depending on, it, yeah, there's the line in the law apparently does say well-being. It talks about the viability of the fetus and it uses this different language. And the problem is that some of the language is so unclear, then it's left to the doctor then. You may not like what I'm saying. I'm just telling you what I read.
Let's take another question.
Okay, we're going to try to go. Hold on just one second.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, the law is...
Try to go lightning round here and try to get through a couple questions real quick. So quick questions, quick answers.
Quick question to the Catholic Church clergy. If I'm a devout Catholic married woman with 12 children and it's a sin for me to use contraception and my husband says, let's have sex, and I say, no, this is my fertile time of the month, whatever, my choices are... commit a sin by refusing my husband, I guess. Commit another sin by asking him to use contraception.
That's a question.
That's for you, Tim.
Okay.
I'm hurrying us through. Well,
it wouldn't be a sin for you to not have sex.
What?
It would not be a sin for you to not have sex.
To deny my husband his rights?
I don't know where. If you could show me in the catechism where anything like that is stated, I'm not aware of that. That's for sure. Maybe you were taught that at some point.
Well, there is
ago,
a scripture
not,
that says that.
Okay, let's try to go one more.
Does that answer your question?
Okay. I don't have a question for the panel, but I just want to say a way to help the man is first, I'm a male counselor at the pregnancy center. And I get to see the father, the FOB, father of baby. And if it is a privilege to get to see them when they come in and looking for answers and looking for people to care about them and understand them. So my push is for more men to volunteer at the pregnancy center. There's a counselor training on the 2nd of February. So please let me know if you have any questions on that. Thank you.
Can we do one more comment of humans who are standing here? Is that all right? That's it. I think that's
humans that are standing.
You can't trust me to hold it. Okay. I've been thinking about this topic for probably 50 years. I worked in my early 20s in a women's health and counseling center that did first trimester abortions. And I also was a psychotherapist dealing with people in the aftermath and that sort of thing. I think what I've kind of concluded is that the real core problem is the shame that people feel. And the shame that gets perpetuated by the ideals that our parents, religious leaders, whoever, government, is saying is how people should live their lives. And what I dealt with the most was the shame. People, young women were ashamed to go to a doctor to get birth control. They were ashamed I mean, I know some people argue, well, they shouldn't have had sex. I just don't think that was realistic, you know? It's the 60s and 70s, and things have changed. But I don't think the rhetoric has changed, and I think that the messages I'm hearing today, not all of you, thankfully, but still that these people are bad, they're sinners, they're not living the ideal life. And I think that perpetuates the problem of women not getting birth control, not feeling good about who they are. And I'd like to know what can be done about that.
I will reiterate something that I think I said earlier but didn't make clear. People are not what's changed. We've been acting the same way for how many thousand of years.
What's changed are the institutions we set up around that define what's right and what's wrong and what's this and what's that. And that's the reality. To say that people are so different now than they were 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago is just not correct. What's correct that's changed is the institutions we put together.
And what's also changed is the ability for women to prevent a pregnancy from ever occurring. A woman who perhaps is married to someone who will not take no for an answer. And that is a reality for many, many, many women. And my heart hurts because the rhetoric from the pro-life side often doesn't take that into consideration. And that's why I used to be the director of the FI Center, and I've moved away from that sort of stringent pro-life view to a view that says, let's take all the resources, including our faith and our ideals, bring them together to give more life to everyone.
I think, thank you for your question. I think as a priest, I mean, my message is, you can ask my students that are here, I'm always telling them, I mean, over and over again, like this, our faith as Christians is not about what we do or don't do. And our value is not based on our mistakes or what we accomplish. It's not about not being a sinner. It's about the fact that God loves us and that he died for us. And he died for us because we are sinners. That's the first thing that happens, is that we're not perfect and we're aware of that. I think there's a difference between shame and a difference between guilt. I think there's an awareness of knowing I've done something wrong, and that leads me to hopefully to change my ways. And then there's shame, which leads me to hate myself, and I would discourage that. All of us in here are wearing clothes, so I think we're all familiar with shame, right? We're only animals that wear clothing.
Shame is what brought this young teenager into my office after her pro-life mother made her have an abortion.
Right.
Because
shame
the
is,
family was ashamed right. that People, their daughter right. got pregnant.
So is the alternative then, I mean, shame, we don't want to feel shame.
Shame
but is
doesn't
the,
produce.
But is the alternative then, do we just not, is there no such thing as right and wrong? I mean, these feelings yeah. come up when we have ideals that we fail to meet. And there's healthy ways to respond to those, to the times that we make mistakes. And there's unhealthy ways, and we need to promote healthy ways to respond to that. But it's not, the answer is not to remove any kind of burden of right doing or acting a good way, or that there's any right and wrong. Okay, culture is everything, and I agree that Jack, the human beings haven't changed. But recently, the Marine Corps, which I was a part of, it's shown statistically that they are the most drunk, drinking. And most sexual partners of all the branches of the military, right? It's because of culture. Yeah, hoorah, right? It's because of culture. It's because of culture in the Marine Corps. I know. I was in the Marine Corps. I know what it was like. That's the culture there. And I think that what we do as a culture is what we're going to see in our people. And I think that's what we need, and that's why I say it's a spiritual problem. It's a soul problem in our nation, and what we need to be focusing on are these ideals, and we need to be promoting something, not shame and not wagging our finger at people, but lifting them up and calling them to something great, calling them to something that I think is written in every single one of our hearts. I think every one of you knows what it looks like to be a good man, to be a good woman, and I think to call and encourage people and not say, well, you're not capable of doing that, you're not capable of living up to that, go on ahead and act however, you know, your instincts and desire. No, but to call people to be great human beings, I think will produce great results. It's not just the government, it's not just the law. I think our responsibility, your responsibility, media's responsibility, we all have a part to play in this.
And I was just going to suggest that changing culture indeed does start with conversations like this. And while it's gotten a little heated, at least in my own heart, I'm really grateful, Ryan, for your presence here and for all of you for coming around this issue that's so hard, which in some ways seems so simple to people on the far edges. But for the rest of us, it's more complex. And thank you for leaning into that.